Voices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for informational and educational purposes only.
Better, stronger, faster. A man barely alive, faster. Better, stronger, faster. Steve Austin, faster. Be that man.
Better than he was before.
Welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally, and with me, as always, is Dr. Scott Stevenson. Scott, how you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm surviving. It's a new year, baby.
We're both surviving. I think we're both a little under the weather today. How are you feeling?
It's not a terrible, nasty cold at all, really. It's just kind of annoying, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. It's funny, because when I got this one, it was just from like trying to do too many things and kind of running myself a little bit ragged. And I literally I'd seen a person, like I hadn't interacted with anybody for maybe like 48 hours beforehand.
Yeah.
So I'm like, how did I get this?
I was thinking the same thing.
Like floating around in the neighborhood when I was walking the dogs, you know, but sometimes, you know, I guess it goes to show that your immune system can be really susceptible if you've kind of overdone it the rest of your life. Yeah.
Well, that can lead me to some educational stuff right out the gate. How do you deal with being sick when it comes to training and nutrition? I assume like something like this, you know, it's not going to do anything to your nutrition. But what about training? What's your rules on that?
Sometimes I usually break them, to be honest, because I like to train.
Yeah.
Because it gives me a respite from feeling bad. I feel better.
Yeah.
Most of the time when I train, if I go into the gym and I start to feel worse when I'm training, then I sort of know I'll sort of plan out, usually kind of a cruise. This is what I've done this time. I planned out to do cruise level workouts. So I'm using Fortitude Train. Basically I go to muscle rounds only and kind of wing it. And keep the volume lower. And, you know, if I were to feel like just absolute like crap, then actually built into the Fortitude Training cruise is a period of no training. So I would just make it that.
Oh, okay.
Like, literally. It could be that, you know, the combination of everything that I'm doing, especially given what we just said about that I haven't been around a bunch of people, all the things I've been taking care of in my life, plus the training has basically made it such that I really do need a deload. So I would just, you know, auto-regulate the deload in that way. So that's how I usually do it. But I've also made the mistake of just like saying, I learned this the hard way. It took me like well over a decade. It took me quite a long while where I would just say, I want to just keep on training and know that eventually my body will catch up.
Yeah.
And I've kept myself sick for months that way.
Oh, I have too. Didn't you just do that last year, was it? I remember you had something and it kept holding on. You're like, yeah, this is just it's just like in me now. You just like you was that last year you did that?
I don't know. It could have been. I don't remember that. I really don't remember like when I'm sick so much. I just by this mindset, if you don't mind, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Maybe we talked about it. There was one time, it was years ago in Arizona, that I remember I was, because I had to like, I was running my gym, so I was getting up early in the morning and, you know, squeezing a lot in my day on a very specific time schedule. And that sucked.
Yeah.
Because I like every day was brutal having to force myself through the day. But maybe, I don't recall, to be honest, Scott, tell you the truth.
Yeah. I think you make a good point too about like, about even recognizing it. You know what I mean? It's like, it's almost worse if you keep talking about it versus just deal with it. It's really not like, for me, it's not that bad. I can live as long as my voice works, which it works pretty well now, and I can get my food in. I can survive. Right.
Yeah, of course. You could survive, but you know, you'll just kind of, you can just sort of degenerate. You're not going to make any training progress.
Yeah.
Just keep on pushing. But, yeah, so I try when I can to like, you know, make it through. And if I've gone more than, you know, I think I've been feeling like crap for just maybe 3 or 4 days, not terrible. You know, I also look at this through my Chinese medical training too. And, you know, I've got what would be considered a Wind Cold exterior invasion. So I'm using some Chinese herbs to treat it in that sense. So my voice, you can tell my voice is a little raspy, but, I've actually been on the phone a lot as of late. So some of that's just from talking and being sick.
Okay.
I'm just kind of running my voice into the ground, but I don't have a sore throat and I don't have a headache. I've just got a runny nose and it's actually better than it was a couple of days ago. So it's not getting worse. According to the various ways you can look at it through the Chinese medical paradigm. So if it goes, so if I start backsliding, then I'll be like, okay, you need to just stop, dude. Put your butt in bed, you know? Yeah. And yeah, so it's, you know, really it's funny because you can come up with hard and fast rules, but it's kind of a matter of like life's priority. Sometimes you just have to go, you know?
Yeah,
you just,
that's true.
You don't have a choice. You hate to expose other people. You know, what we don't do, is people don't wear masks, you know,
no.
And we probably should a lot of times.
You see that in other cultures.
Yeah, exactly there. I mean, it's smart, you know, it's not like you, when you go into a, you know, you're waiting in a bank line and you're coughing, you're sniffling and, you know, you sound horrible that people don't know you're sick.
Yeah.
But, we just don't like to do that. It is a cultural thing, I think. So,
yeah, I could see that. Yep. So hey, I've got some really cool news. We've been talking about it through the week on Advices. I mentioned it on Bodybuilding Nerds Radio last Friday. Was True Nutrition is on board now with the Advices Radio Network. They are sponsoring the show.
That's awesome. Yeah, congratulations. That's big.
Thanks, man. I'm really excited because you know what? It's a company that I believe in, and I feel like. I feel like they are already kind of like intertwined with everything we already do, you know? And I mean, you've been, affiliated with Dante. You've known him basically forever. And so has Skip, you know, guys have all gone way back. And I just feel like a lot of the ethic that I feel like I've learned from you guys is kind of tied in with what True Nutrition does. It's a good fit to me. I'm really, really excited about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people may not know the origins of True Nutrition, which was True Protein before that, but it was basically, Dante and his business partner, they got together. They just like, this is just crazy how people are ripping off customers by having them pay so much more for packaging and all this kind of stuff when you could just get them the raw materials, which is all like, you know, your kind of hardcore bodybuilder wants. Just give me a bag of protein.
Right.
And they literally still sell bags of protein. You can still get the, you know, they've changed the bags that they use over the years, you know, depending on what they could find and I think the industry standards, but you can still just get basically unadulterated raw supplement.
Right.
Which is phenomenal, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of cool. You don't see it very often, at least not in this industry where, you know, we're sort of inundated with people sort of trying to sleuth things past you. And, you know, if you look at like, of course, like the black market, people are constantly scamming. They provide good product and then they provide crappy product and they vanish before they get totally found out. And Dante's just kind of stuck to his word and stuck to his principles of, you know, and it's paid off. It's not like he's doing pretty well financially, I think. Obviously, the company's been around for a while, and they've got their manufacturing company that they use in the background. But he just kind of stuck to some basic bare bones principles of trying to provide stuff at the best price possible. And I think, you know, I'm pretty sure, I don't want to speak for them, but I think they've got a price matching policy. They used to. That was part of their advertising push. But they don't even have to push that anymore because no one comes close. I don't even really have to check because you never see protein at the prices that they offer it. Just no one can, they can't match them.
Yeah. Well, I like the fact, like you had said too, it's nice to be a part of something that you can trust. That's what I'm keen on. And, mm-hmm. And I like being able to, add stuff in. Like I was mentioning before, I use a bag of their citrulline malate. And so no mm-hmm. matter what, like I've been using whatever pre-workout I want to use, if I want to use a pre-workout, I could just throw that right in there to, you know, boost that up so I can get, you know, the 6-8 grams that I want to use. It's cool stuff. It's good. It's good.
Yeah. Yeah. It used to be you could actually make your own for a while. And that was something that I don't think that they literally legally can do, but that was really nice. But you can exactly create your own supplement. You can create, you know, different combinations if you want different things based on different days. Like, you know, you want to have whey protein isolate that's going to be had during a workout versus, combined with the casein if it's at nighttime. Like you can mix and match, in any way you want. And,
I think so you can still do that.
You can to a certain degree. There used to be like literally you could create whatever kind of complex supplement you wanted to.
Huh.
Yeah, and they have a system now. I haven't used it because I just buy the bags and I just combine them. Like, you know, I've been doing this for so long. I know kind of what I want to have, and I just, you know, sort of run it through my head.
Right.
I think kind of like, you know, like someone who's a chef. You see the guys, they're not measuring out, you know, every bits and piece. They just kind of eyeball it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it used to be like you could get like a jug of a supplement that contained like creatine, citrulline malate, and agmatine, and whatever you wanted to put. You could literally create your own special, and then you could reorder that.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Legally, basically, you can't combine things in that way, because you need to get approval from the government to a formula of that type.
That's so weird. But you can buy the agmatine, the citrulline, the creatine, and then combine it yourself.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, people. If you look at it's just human nature. You want to get you. Of course, you want something that you have. There's a sense that when you get a pre-made formula like that you're getting precision and specificity in some way, shape, or form to match your circumstances. So it's like, okay, someone's thought this out.
Yeah,
this is kind of the best supplement that I can put together. So, you know, and you trust in the company, like if it's Granite, for instance, like you trust that there's reasons for those ratios and those amounts. They're clinically dosed, what have you haven't been fairy dusted. And plus it's a huge time saver, you know,
right.
If you have an intra-workout, you get that. But, you can, if you're so much of your life, like many of the people that are listening to this now, and you're spending, you know, at least 10 hours a week at the gym or driving to the gym, then, you know, you can probably cordon off, you know, like a 2x4 section of an island in your kitchen or a countertop or something like that, and put, arrange all the bags and bottles of supplements in a way that you can make your own. And it's just an extra probably 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah.
But you save a good bit that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, that's kind of the way I've looked at it. It's like the price is like, you can go, I kind of challenge anyone to do it. Use the, what's the discount code, Scott?
It is Advices.
Advices, easy. Pick up some, you can run that through and get a price, you know, get all the way to the end of your purchase on the cart. Of course, buy it if you want to, that would be the end goal. But, you know, manufacture, if you can, a duplicate of some pre-made, supplement that you may be using. The problem, of course, will be that you're going to run into proprietary blends. You may not know what's in there.
Sure.
You know, so, but find one and then check it out and see how well it matches and then propagate that over the course of a year. So if you're saving, I don't know, let's say it's $5 a month, you know, that's $60 in a year. That's maybe a massage, perhaps. You got a good deal on massages, or that's another 2 canisters of whatever that supplement might be.
Right.
You know, so that can add up. Chances are it's much more than that.
Yeah, I would think so. I know that like when I've bought a bag of EAA, it seems to last forever, you know?
Absolutely. And if you buy like protein, you know, in big amounts, I think if you go over 15 pounds there, then you get an extra 10% off maybe or something like that.
Nice.
So yeah, so I order 16 pounds of protein all the time.
Do you?
You know, oh yeah, constantly. I'll order, usually my orders are $300 or $400 when I order from them, because I get, you know, two or three kinds of protein, an intra-workout, just a general use protein, and sometimes a night protein, and then whatever other ingredients I need.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know we were talking before we started. It sounds like the lawn guys showed up.
Yeah, I'm actually behind two closed doors now. I've gone back in the back of the house. They're either weed eating or they're blowing leaves and stuff around. So
I couldn't hear that much. I just knew the dogs were telling you, hey, there's somebody in the yard.
Yeah. either we stop and I say be quiet and then they'll quiet down, or I sort of try to avoid them and hope they'll quiet down. And
I think people don't mind it. I actually, one guy said, he was like, just let the dogs go. It's just part of it's just part of life. Dogs are gonna bark, right?
You know, it's authentic.
And, yes.
Yeah. Someone hasn't taken over my body and decided to run the world through the podcast as me.
Yeah. Hey, so I didn't want to make it like a big commercial thing. But I did want to mention that to everybody about True Nutrition. The other thing I wanted to mention was, once again, now we have your seminar that's coming up with John Meadows in Columbus. Yes. Is that going to be the 28th?
Last day of February. Yep.
Okay, perfect. So that'll be Thursday, right before the Arnold. I'm going to plan on getting in town early so that I could be there to check this out. I'm cool. Excited, man. I know you said you were gonna write a couple of new talks, lectures that you were gonna give, and I know you've been super busy. So I bet you haven't even begun that yet. That's my guess, but you might surprise me. Have you started those things yet?
Not formally, but I've scratched out some ideas. When ideas come to me, I put them on a little notepad on my computer.
Okay.
That I keep the ideas together. Yeah, I'm looking. I've got one. I forget even what I titled it, but basically it's about. And John and I kind of came up with this topic because he's constantly asked this, and so am I. People want to know how much to train. How can they figure this out? How do they balance out their frequency and their volume and their sets and their reps?
Sure.
And you know, what's the equation for the formula that will tell you what you should be doing in the gym? And you can get so lost in, I think we might get to like one of the questions about Mike Isertel's ideas, and you can get lost in the subtle nuances, and like go like deep into this, you know, maximal recoverable volume and maximal adaptable volume and minimum recoverable or minimum adaptive volume, or the various terms that he or other people have come up with, and just get totally lost in the volume scenario.
Yeah.
And then you kind of forget about frequency. And there are ways you can kind of do that. It's a lot of times with bodybuilding, it's not really rocket science. You can take the science, and then the science will basically lead you back, at least the way I look at it, to some pretty simple ways to kind of piece things together. So I think that's going to be really, really useful for people, because it's so easy to get lost in a sea of details, totally unnecessarily. And the science actually will tell you various ways that there's no need to get lost in a sea of details.
Interesting.
Because, yeah, I mean, a lot of that's because of the principle of individuality.
Yeah.
You know? That's really what a lot of it will come back down to. But so I'm looking forward to that one. And the mind muscle, I'm doing one, I think I called it Mind Muscle Mastery or something kind of catchy like that. And that's going to be fun, because I'm going to get to talk about, at least the way I'm going to put it together initially, is to talk about muscle activation and what's going on there neurologically.
Hmm.
And the science around, you know, to what degree people can manipulate that, and to what degree a lot of what's going on when we pick up a load or we manipulate a load in space, or we, you know, the muscles are active, is something that's subject to voluntary control, but it's also subject to a lot of reflexive information.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it's stuff like that. Even if I don't necessarily need that information to carry forward and do my workout, I take that with me. I feel like listening to you over the last years, Scott. I've been training more instinctively lately, and I take off a day when I need it. But it's having information like what you're talking about here that I feel like better informs me to make that decision, whether I'm going to train that day or whether I'm going to take it off, or just listening to my body better, I guess, is what it comes down to.
Right. Right. I mean, you're not going to like go into the gym. I mean, I might do this because this is, you know, I've just kind of like, I've been looking into stuff for so long, and I've sort of ironed into my head, you know, connecting things anatomically and biomechanically and neurologically and just how I like to sort of view things from a geeky scientific perspective. But you're not going to like listen to me talk about, you know, proprioception and stretch reflexes and you know, Golgi tendon organs and rate coding and, you know, motor unit activity, all that kind of, and think, okay, now I'm going to apply that all that information and that's going to tell me how, you know, I should go and build bigger pecs. But you will look at that and you get, you know what? There's a whole bunch of things here that give me pause. For instance, when someone says, oh, you got a bench to get a big chest.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, really? Okay. Is that why do you think about it? Like, there's so many bits and pieces and complexities in there, which suggest that there are other ways to go about creating the stimulus other than what most people want to do.
Okay. Yeah.
And, yeah. So that information, you don't have to have it on the tip of your fingers, but it tells you that it's okay to look outside the box that most people take things into.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. I wanted to tell you too, just briefly on my training, that I'm certain that I'm not doing your style training, but listening to you and having split my workouts up, doing more frequency with less volume, or the same amount of volume I had been doing before at most, I'm seeing in my pecs a change. I'm doing my best now. It's hard for me to split that up still in my other body parts, but I've been really trying, and just because it's been huge, like it really has. I've seen my pecs develop having split them up on that frequency, like twice a week now in general, but with less volume per workout. They've changed so much in the last year or two alone. I'm just telling myself now, like, I got to do that with back, and I'm taking that mindset of getting in and working really hard, but really limiting the amount of time that I'm doing it, and then stopping, and then coming back a few days later and doing the same thing again.
There's the catch 22 there is that when you have a muscle group that doesn't respond very well, it's sort of weak and stubborn.
Yeah.
Then you just want to obliterate. You want to pull a, you know, CT Fletcher and, you know, command that muscle to grow, you know, and just like destroy it. Of course that doesn't work for a lot of people. And like reasons that I've talked about before on the show, like this notion of muscle soreness, you know, possibly indicating that you've sort of overwhelmed the protein synthetic capacity of the muscles. So when you get really, really sore, that's not really possibly a good thing. Or that responders tend to be people, we're just thinking about muscles that respond, or people that have responsive muscles, those being the ones that were measured in the science that I'm thinking of, they get these really good growth factor responses that turn on satellite cell activity, and those who don't get those types of responses. So you're going to need to maybe elicit, if you get a weak response growth factor wise in terms of urging the satellite cells to do their job and allowing the muscles to get larger, then you're going to have to do that more often, because you just get kind of like a piddly little output satellite cell from each workout if you're not a good responder in that particular muscle. So it's over and done. You may not reach the threshold necessary with any workout. And you do too much, you may overwhelm the protein synthetic capacity. So you want to increase those growth factors and increase the satellite selectivity as regularly as possible, and still recover, of course. So Like those two, those are two different separate lines of evidence kind of point to the idea of not doing too much where you get just crazy sore, and training frequently enough, of course, with the idea that you need to recover as well. So those both, that's like the science, some sciencey notions that, that point to what you're seeing or you've been experiencing now in the last year, year and a half, in your chest at least.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, and the thing is, of course, when you see, when you see that the people who have sort of the best backs or the best chests, those are responders. They have, they play by different rules. You know, those muscles grew. They're like your calves.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You know, you're a great example. You know, I'm sure you probably get tired of people picking on your calves and talking about your calves all the time, but you know, it's really kind of fascinating as to your calves are just like absolutely world class. They're just outstanding. They're ridiculous. You know.
Well, thank you, but I at the same time I'm not like, well, thank you. I'm so proud of all the labor I've put in. You know.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, someone who has every muscle group that responds like that, who's just basically a natural bodybuilder because they've just got genetics that do that. Or, you know, maybe it was a matter of you know, physical activity when they're a kid that led to epigenetic changes or what have you that made them a pretty good responder to bodybuilding training. But if everything grew like that, then you ascribe it to yourself to a certain degree. It's a tough thing to step back and say, I'm just lucky. You know, this isn't me. This is just because I got good genes. It has nothing to do with me. Our egos want to claim,
yeah,
you know, that success, but you've got the contrast built into your body, you know, of being someone who's now at this point struggling for every new ounce of muscle, but right there in front of your face is an example within you of a muscle that you don't even have to train them.
It's like a glimpse of being Flex Wheeler without actually getting to look like Flex Wheeler.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and there's a constant reminder there, you know. I mean, one thing you could even do is think, you know, okay, my back and my calves are completely different. I'm going to have to do totally different things for your calves. Like, don't even train your calves. You know, and your back, you're going to have to use every little technique possible to massage your recovery and the nature of the stimulus to promote muscle growth in your back musculature.
Yes.
You know, and that's kind of a cool thing. Like it's in a way, you're going to laugh when I say this, but your calves are to you what Dave Henry has been to me.
I see what you mean. I get it.
As a reminder of the importance of genetics, so to speak, or other factors that are sort of beyond your control.
Yeah.
You know, you weren't like as a child thinking, I'm gonna do things during my childhood, my growth and development to ensure that I have gigantic calves as an adult.
Yeah.
And it came about, you know, without any willful desire on your part.
I don't think there's nothing I could do to have made them, you know, what they are. I guess it's just, I don't know. It's just, I'm speechless, I guess, when I think of them. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. I mean, well, you do walk on your toes, right?
Yes, and I used to, yeah, more so. And I don't as much now, but if I go to run, that's the first thing I do is I'll go up to my toes. Like I'll sprint more than anything else.
A lot of people when they, you know, barefoot running, I don't know how in vogue it is now, but it was a big deal when the five fingers shoes came out. All that, but that's how people will tend to run when they don't have footwear.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, many people will have they won't use a heel strike like we typically do now.
And that's what you're supposed to do, right? I think I was taught some running stuff in my weightlifting class in college, but I don't think I was ever really formally trained. That's what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to, there is a form to it is what you're telling me.
Well, I mean, I'm no expert. I looked into this at one point in time and when I did, I recall it being kind of controversial, because you know, there aren't very many cultures where people are running around barefoot all the time, you know, but that's kind of the idea, is that the heel strike is something that only can develop biomechanically when you've got footwear on to permit that. Otherwise, you know, a 4-foot strike is more natural, and that's sort of anatomically correct. So what you're supposed to do, you know, probably is a matter of what you've got on your foot.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, so you may have been doing what, you know, was sort of built into us through evolution as far as walking and running, and you're just more inclined to that, even when you're wearing footwear, than other people would be.
You know, I noticed yesterday I was doing shoulders, lateral raises, and I know I've done this on multiple exercises. As the weight was getting more difficult, I try not to bounce. You know, I try not to, like, you know, you see some people, they kind of like, they cushion their knees a little bit and then they bounce with the reps. I try to keep my body stay still, but in the position, in the process of locking myself so that I don't bounce, I go onto my toes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're neurologically wired to make use of the calf musculature.
Yeah. I guess they're there. You better use them for something.
Right. Right. But not everyone would do that, you know?
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Cause people mention stuff from time to time and I don't really think about the differences, but yeah, that's something I was thinking yesterday. I bet not everybody does this when they're doing their lateral raises or curls or, you know, whatever. I probably do that more often than I realize.
You can see there's other examples. I mean, good trainers have probably noticed this, or people who work with a lot of folks, and like people with good glutes and hamstrings, they'll tend to, when they bend over, they will keep their back in an anatomically neutral position with the normal lordosis curvature of the spine. So the kipping forward of the upper body is at the hinge joint of the hip. And that's a function of gluteal and hamstring, you know, posterior chain activation in those muscles. Whereas people with someone's got quote unquote flat ass, you'll see when they bend over, there's a lot of lumbar flexion.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. I've been paying attention to that in myself, just, you know, through the course of trying to develop my glutes. I know exactly what you mean. And I could picture that. So you're saying people with good glutes are basically like doing a stiff leg dead when they bend over.
Yeah. You'll see. It's just, that musculature is stronger, so they can use that. And they probably were, you know, neurologically inclined to do that, and that's why the muscle's stronger. So the two things sort of, you know, perpetuate one another. And that's a broad, you know, sweeping stroke kind of comment. It's not like, you know, that's an absolute case of everyone. But I mean, you can see it this way too. Like if your glutes and hamstrings are super duper sore, then you're not going to want to use them, and your movement patterns change such that those aren't activated and they're not getting stretched out, unless you like are conscious of, you know, I need to make sure I'm using my legs and my glutes normally.
Yeah.
As well. Like if your quads are really sore, you know, like imagine like you just destroyed your legs and there's something on the floor, you know, like literally someone dropped a coin down there and you have to pick it up. Like he'll do all sorts of weird shit to get down. You're like, you know, find a table, you know, that you can hold yourself on while you get down on the floor, and then you crawl to it, you know?
Yeah.
But most people aren't going to just like squat down through that pain of really, really sore legs and pick it up. They'll like, you know, you take like a really wide stance, and then maybe kind of like, you know, do sort of a wide, like sumo style deadlift type of thing with a lot of, with poor back posture, and try to get your finger to the floor.
Yeah. Slash limbo, possibly like a limbo move.
The limbo. No, not like lean back limbo, you mean?
One of the two, either way, just like figuring out how to get your body down low.
Yeah. Some weird thing. And then a lot of people who have big traps, you can see it in how they're activating their back when they're doing all sorts of things. Head presses, it's a lot of shoulder shrugging that's involved with it. When they're doing side laterals, a lot of shoulder shrugging. When they're doing back movements, rowing movements, you can see there's a lot of shoulder girdle elevation. And you know, a lot of you can just kind of tell they're just don't. There's a lot of movement there. A lot of the movement drive is almost like they've got a built-in sort of kind of body English type of biomechanical pattern that involves initiating the movement with the traps.
Yeah.
And that's a really good point to tell people, like if they're trying to train their delts and they can't seem to do that, is initiate the movement with the target muscle. So like people do it all the time on their chest. Instead of holding their scapula back, this is one of the things that keeps you from using the scapular protractors, the serratus anterior, and then it keeps the anterior delts out of it. If you hold your scapula back, that basically, you know, prevents that musculature. If you can't hold that posture in your shoulder girdles and at the same time activate the scapular protractors, which bring the shoulder girdles to the front and kind of hunch your shoulders forward, and the anterior delts, those two things are just basically mutually exclusive. So the musculature that you have left is the pec major mainly. So that's why that's a great talking point for people when they want to do their chest. So if you, like people, you see it on squats too, you know, someone who doesn't get great, leg development from squats, you'll see they'll squat down.
Okay.
And or they're using too much weight and they squat down. And the first thing that happens is they come forward with the bar and their butt sticks out and they use their low back.
Yeah.
Some glute activation, as opposed to you see guys like the guys who like Ruly Winkler is a great example. If you watch him squat, he's strong as fucking hell on squats, like 800-pound squats. And he does them. It almost looks like he's on a Smith machine or something, but he's with a free bar. Is that he's got his body really pretty upright. Tom Platt, the high bar squat, the way he did it, you know, kept his back out of the deal. And if they've just probably a natural inclination, and then they train themselves to really engage the leg musculature and not the low back in order to bring the bar up.
I think, you know what, so much of what, a lot of times, you know, I have people that ask me, you know, and ask you, they ask us on all these shows, like how to bring up weak body parts. I feel like the key is in what you're telling us right now, you know, because it's like if you have weak shoulders and you're wondering like, how can I bring my shoulders up? I feel like the first thing you might want to look at then is like, okay, look at your traps, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like because you see guys doing, say, a lateral raise, and it's all trap activity, you know, it's all trap activity. And that's why their shoulders aren't growing. You know, we talk to guys like, and these are questions I ask myself, you know, how do I bring my legs up? Well, how am I squatting? And that's going to be the key, right? Get the tension to the muscle you're trying to build. Because I've seen people that'll be like, hey, the judges told me I had to bring up my legs. And so I'm going to do everything I can. I've been doing 500 pounds for reps. I saw a guy do this as a middleweight. And he came back the next season. His legs were still small. And he didn't change anything to do with his form. He just did more weight.
Right. Yeah, and he probably, you know, got good growth in maybe his glutes and his quadratus lumborum and his spinal erectors. And, it's interesting, Scott, because that is one way to look at it. It kind of depends on the person. Like if you can be totally missing the boat in terms of like now we're getting the mind muscle connection idea.
Okay.
As you're using accessory muscles or what would normally be stabilizer muscles more so as prime movers.
Mm.
So you're making the traps a prime mover on a lateral raise when you want the delts to be a prime mover.
Yeah.
So one strategy to prevent that is ensure that you just got isometric contractions in your traps. They're not dynamic. There's no concentric, you know, first initiation of the movement in the traps. And then you're basically leaving it to shoulder abduction in whatever, you know, arc fits best for your biomechanics, what you feel right. And then you're basically eliminating movement brought on by muscles other than the one you're trying to target, the deltoid in this case.
So when you say isometric contraction, are you saying that you would then pinch your traps? You would squeeze your traps from the start?
Isometric just means there's no change in the length. Okay. It doesn't mean that they're like, you've got your shoulders shrugged. You can, like anytime you're holding a weight in your hands, unless you're like literally ripping your shoulder girdles from your body, the traps are going to be contracting isometrically. Any movement. So you're just making sure that you don't have any up and down shrugging going on.
I see.
Like a trainer might, like literally you could stand behind someone and just put your fingers on the person's traps and say, don't let your, like chest above them.
Yeah.
Don't your traps pressed into my fingers.
Yeah.
Stay down. And that will greatly limit the range of motion too. Most people won't be able to get their hands to, you know, ear level at all if they do that.
Just oh, I bet. Shoulder,
yeah, the shoulder joint doesn't permit that.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. But then on the other side, this is where you can see this if you've got it. You know, a trained or kind of experienced eye, because I pick up on this just from, you know, having watched many people. And like Dave Henry is a perfect example of just someone who has a really good knack. Even though you might see movement in accessory muscles, he still has a really good knack for making the target muscle the prime mover and the driver of the movement. So the primarily trained muscle for a given exercise. And Roddy Coleman did it too. I mean, he paid the piper because of the loads he ended up using. But if you look at him like doing those T-bar rows in the corner with like 12 plates, yeah, or whatever he did, he's got some body English in there. But what I sense when I see him, and you could kind of document this with EMG, and there's a little bit of research that's been done comparing like kind of good with really good bodybuilders in terms of how they can increase the EMG as you increase loads in the target muscle. People that are more advanced and have been training longer do a better job of sort of incrementally increasing the EMG as the load gets higher, whereas people who aren't so advanced, they won't. When the load gets higher and higher and higher, they're no longer increasing their ability to move those heavier loads through activating the target muscle. They're doing it by bringing in accessory muscles. They're cheating, basically. And you can kind of document that with an EMG as your measure of muscle activity.
Okay.
But here's the thing. Now we're going to go deep. We didn't plan to talk about this topic, but it's
no, this is good. This is good stuff though.
It is good stuff. So muscle, this is the force velocity curve. I think I just posted a Facebook memory that I did a video on this a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Outside of my back porch. So there's the most important aspect of muscle physiology is the force velocity curve, which dictates for mammalian skeletal muscle that you've got greater force production capacity during eccentric or lowering exercises than you do during lifting exercises. So you're weaker in the concentric, you're stronger on the eccentric. You could have someone do a bench press or an incline press or a squat, and you could load them up to 10 or 20% above their one rep max, what they could literally lower and lift back up. And they could lower that under control. They wouldn't come back up with it, but they could lower it, and they might even be able to hold it for a split second. But you can produce much more force when the muscle is lengthening for a given amount of muscle that's activated than you can when the muscle's shortening. And, of course, faster you're trying to move something, the less amount of force you can produce. Till eventually, like at your fastest velocity of contraction, you can hardly produce any force. So that's the thing, is that when you're lifting, let's say it's a dumbbell side lateral. And this is a great one because form is so variable; it's all over the place.
Yeah.
Some people like to do them really strict. They're like literally like an automaton, like one of those, you know, robots from Walt Disney World, where you're on the ride and they can just move like two joints at a time and nothing else moves.
Yeah.
So they're just, it's pure shoulder abduction. Not a bit of body English anywhere. And that's a great way to ensure that's the muscle that's being used. But if you look at the stimulus that you're producing, that you want to create in a muscle, you can take into account this force-velocity relationship, which demonstrates that you can, which says that you can produce more force lowering a load than you can lifting it.
Yeah.
So if you want to match the force velocity curve and basically produce as much overload on the lowering of the weight, you're going to have a heavier weight than you could probably lift with control. So basically you can do, this is what cheat reps are about, forced reps are about. So you take a set to failure and then you no longer can lift unless your partner helps you, they force the rep,
yeah,
but you can still do those negatives. And eventually you come to a point where, you're having both concentric and eccentric failure. But those cheat reps allow you to continue the set.
Yeah.
Weaker on the concentric than you are on the eccentric. That's the intrinsic nature of skeletal muscles dictated by this force velocity curve. So if you got someone, let's say, who is just really, really good, like Ronnie Coleman or Dave Henry or lots of high-level people that you'll see. I think this is one of the things that sort of separates really good bodybuilders just in general from those who maybe aren't, is their ability to do this. If you got someone doing dumbbell side laterals, and they can do a really good job of activating the deltoid, they can literally do with themselves forced reps in a certain sense by adding some body English to bring the weight up and then lowering under control just using the deltoid. Hmm. So you can imagine this. Imagine you take some electrodes and you put them on the delt and you activate it. And so the delt's turned on. And let's say you've got it activated with just enough current that you can't raise the load. The person's holding onto the weight. If you just lifted that weight up, it would go up, the muscle would stay active, we'll just kind of ignore fatigue here for a while. And then if you let go, it would just stay. Hmm. It wouldn't come back down. Because if it came back down, that would be an eccentric contraction. And the muscle in and of itself, by its very nature, can produce more force during the lowering.
Yeah.
So now substitute those electrodes and the electrical activity for someone who really knows how to connect with the deltoid. And they figured out over time how to kind of do this kind of mind-muscle connection. They can give just enough body English so that they're putting in maximal effort with the deltoid and lifting it up. And then they're not doing anything to assist in holding that weight up. They're just using the naturally greater force production ability of the muscle during the eccentric and really overloading the eccentric with a really heavy weight. Hmm. So they're basically doing, and you might even go through a set where the first rep, because the weight's the same, you know, and there's fatigue will ensue over the course of the set. The first rep is pretty clean. It's just basically shoulder abduction, pure deltoid. And then as the set gets a little bit more difficult and fatigue starts to ensue, they start adding a little bit of body English.
Yeah.
Assist, because they can't get the weight up without that because the muscle's getting fatigued, but they can still lower it.
Yeah.
And then a little bit more, and eventually they get to the point where there's so much fatigue that they can no longer lower the weight under control, and then the set's over. Does that make sense? What I just sort of
I try to do that. I heard Dorian say one time that he said there's three types of failure. There's the positive, and then there's you fail in a static hold, and then you fail in the negative. He was like, so just because you can't do a positive rep anymore doesn't mean that you've totally failed. You can still do negatives. And so I hear that in my head when I'm training. And I have, I'll, and that's what I would call a cheat rep. You know, that's like, if I do some type of a cheat rep at the end, it's to get that weight up so that I can control it down. Cause I know that I still have that strength left in me for the negative.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what I try to do.
Yeah. So then people will look at someone doing that, who really, you know, under the hood, from a neurological perspective, from a neural perspective, they're doing a great job of activating the target muscle. They're just adding body English into the set to extend the set and create further quote unquote inroads to, you know, reach concentric, isometric and eccentric failure. If you want to look at it from that standpoint. And they'd say, well, that look at all the body English. That's just sloppy. That's awful.
Mm,
You know? And with someone who's a beginner, you would probably think, okay, unless they're just naturally really athletic and they've just got a, you know, good just natural ability to figure out how to bodybuild effectively, those you'd say, okay, we want to make sure you're really getting your delts targeted here, because I can just see, I'm looking at you and I'm seeing all this sort of weird, you know, behavior, and you're kind of like flopping around all over the place, shrugging your shoulders a whole lot. I don't see what looks like a highly skilled movement.
Okay.
It looks like every rep you're trying to kind of figure out a different strategy to get the weight up, and maybe even you can see there's like a certain sometimes people, when they get in pain, you can either like some people, and you'll see this like especially with beginners or intermediates, their pain strategy is to try to avoid the pain. Yeah. They're like hoping that the set will end, and they're closing their eyes because they wish they could just like take themselves somewhere other than where they are in the set. Whereas other people, they may close their eyes so they can focus and make sure that they're making the primary mover of during the exercise, that target muscle. And that's when you see like what looks like a very skillful movement, and you know, they're the same kind of strategies employed to a little bit more degree, just like you were saying you do, as the set ensues and the fatigue ensues, and you can see they're really focused on what probably is the target muscle. That's someone who's doing what we're just talking about.
Yeah.
So on the one end, you got people that are just like, they're not using the prime mover and they're just being sloppy, and that's quote unquote poor form. Whereas on the other end, you can bring in the accessory muscles and do what would look like poor form if you don't know what you're looking at. And that's actually a better way to match the loading during the course of the set with what the muscle can do in terms of the force velocity relationship.
I like what you just did with that there.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why when people, you know, are sort of like, you know, they're form, the form Nazis and the form sticklers, it's kind of like, you know, like you're missing out. And when you say that, you're missing out on the fact that muscle has this force velocity relationship, which really dictates how much force it can produce. And I mean, there's research too. In fact, I was kind of connected with some of this. Like there's a particular study which formed the basis of the model that I used for my dissertation, and they used electrical stimulation. And actually, they've done this just with voluntary activation. You can just look at some of the studies where they compare like an isotonic, which is the scientific term for just like free weight lifting,
yeah,
with using a isokinetic dynamometer. Isokinetic dynamometer keeps the speed of contraction the same no matter how hard you push. So you can do a 10-rep set every repetition. Could be, let's say it's a knee extension, a second up and a second down, and every rep can be all out.
Okay.
Force that you produce on the way down could be 40 or 50% greater than the force you produce on the way up. Because the machine forces your leg down. You're kicking as hard as you can, trying to extend. Machine's going to come down. It's, you know, many times stronger than any human being. So you're producing tremendous eccentric overload when you do that. And when they've done those comparative studies where someone, you know, it's 100 pounds on the way up, and then it's pretty easy on the way down until eventually they would reach just a concentric failure point. In this case, all of those reps are maximal efforts. Imagine like if you be like starting with basically your concentric max on, let's say, an incline press or what have you, and you've got like three spotters. This is what it would take, essentially.
Okay.
And the first reps max, and then the bar comes down and they push down. It's just hard enough where you can barely control that. It's a max effort. You're just pushing as hard as they can, up and down through the entire set. and they're just moving the bar up and down for you.
Yeah.
All out continuously. So that kind of training or that matches the force velocity curve. That matches the muscle's force production capacities during concentric and lengthening and shortening contractions. So that's what, you know, someone who's got a good knack for throwing body English can do. And I think it can help with growth. It's programmatically, it's kind of a pain in the butt because, you know, you have one day when you just go in and you're amped up and you've, you know, taken a bunch of caffeine and your pre-workout, and you just have the tendency to like want to engage all that extra musculature, and you've got a little more oomph, a little more pep in your step, et cetera.
Yeah.
And you may do more of that on some days than another. So it's important to kind of maybe standardize, you know, how much pre-stim, pre-workout stims you take, and how and when you apply those.
And then also to take it further, like your rest, your pre-workout nutrition, because all those, you know, your hydration, I think all those factors mm-hmm. affect how much I have to go in, you know?
Right. And then something, I mean, Dante, speaking of Dante, he's said this, he was something he would employ a lot with people is if you're trying to do progressive overload, and you're moving up, eventually people, you will get to the point where you become so logbook oriented that your form does get shitty. You know, you're no longer like truthfully applying about a body English that is helpful.
Yeah.
For stimulating the target muscle. Now you're just cheating. Now you actually are. So then you go back and you reset your form.
Yeah.
And you start doing those side laterals like with perfect form. You know, no body English at all. Maybe you do them seated instead of standing. So you can't, you know, throw in any back extension to help bring the load up on the concentric for the delts.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So yeah, so you can go back and forth, but yeah, so the form police, that's a kind of a binary, I think, somewhat limited way of looking at how resistance exercise should be performed to produce muscle growth.
All right. Well, hey, listen, we've got you all fired up. We probably got enough time for right. one question. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and we'll tackle a question from the board.
Perfect.
Hey guys, if you've enjoyed the education that Scott Stevenson has provided to us here on Muscle Minds, then definitely check out his book. That's Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach. What we can get into the shows is just a fraction of the information that Scott has to share. He's dedicated his life, really, to bodybuilding, and he's filled the pages with all of this great information. It's super well organized, and I believe that you could take any physique to the next level. I'm not just saying that. I seriously believe that. I bought the hardcover. You can get the hardcover at Amazon, or if you're international, at Barnes & Noble. You can go to byobbcoach.com and you can get the ebook there. It's a beautiful book. It's well written. He put his heart into this thing. Also, guys, check out fortitudetraining.net for his fortitude training guide, the plan that we talk about all the time here on the show. And hopefully I will see you along with Scott and John Meadows at their seminar. It's going to be on February 28th, Thursday before the Arnold. If you're heading out, be sure to stop in and check out the seminar. It's going to be awesome. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Hey, guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends, and they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com, and use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows. All right, guys, and we are back. Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. Yeah, you're fired up, Scott. Let's get you rolling on a question yeah. here.
Keep the momentum.
And we got something we could talk training here. Says, what do you think of Mike Isratel's approach to training volume regarding the volume landmarks and the way he periodizes training for physique athletes? Now, I know that you've looked at all the questions ahead. You've prepared some thoughts. Can you first illuminate for me what he's talking about here as far as periodizing training for physique athletes?
As far as periodizing? So actually, I just did on the Revive Stronger podcast with Steve Hall. It hasn't come out yet, but it may come out actually within a few days of when this one makes its way out. We, Mike and I did the podcast together.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fun.
Keep me posted. Yeah. We'll post that up at the Advices page on Facebook. Let everybody know that it's out.
Yeah. As far as periodization per se, I think actually when I first read this and thought about this, this question, we hadn't even done that, podcast. So I had to go and kind of look into what he does, but the basic idea, and I like this, is he sort of uses the principle that, that I employ and that I think is a good way to look at things, is try to get the most from the least. So generally his way of periodizing, as far as I understand it, this is kind of a broad stroke. Of course, I can't speak for Mike, but is that you start off at the beginning of a mesocycle, or what I might call a blast, or beginning of a major kind of training push, with less volume, because you don't need so much volume to create a stimulus for growth. And you can see this just in the fact that although there is this repeated bout effect that is a protective effect from previously having trained, so you don't get sore. So you're not like, you haven't completely lost that, even if you've taken a week or two off of training compared to if you hadn't trained for a year. You still can sense that you're getting a little more sore than you would have otherwise for any given particular training bout. So starts off with less training volume beginning and generally builds that up. And I don't know where Mike stands as far as auto-regulation, when you've set out a schema like that. His general idea is that in an ideal world, and Mike really is, people kind of, at least the impression I got is that people sort of ascribe to him much more of a black and white way of thinking about things than he really has. His ideas are mainly directed to sort of beginner and intermediate level people who need sort of more of a black and white type of approach, because you follow that road. It's sort of like someone who wants to kind of learn to do some like off-road four-wheeling, and they just learn how to operate the four-wheeler.
Okay.
So they just get on a track with a lot of bumps, and they just kind of go around the track, and they sort of learn their way around. And then once they figure out how to navigate hills and make quick turns and do slides and change gears, then they can go out into the real open terrain and figure out how to deal with that. So when you first start off training, you can use this approach where you get the most from the least, as I would phrase it, train with lower volume and then increase your volume over the course of a training mesocycle until eventually you do a deload.
Okay.
He has these volume landmarks, the minimum, the maximum, sort of the minimum adaptive volume, maximal recoverable volume, and basically sort of the low and highs. With one of the things we talked about on the Revive Stronger podcast is that's highly variable. So he has sort of suggested, set ranges, which for me would be way too high. Of course, you have to contextualize those with the training frequency. Those are with the idea of, I think, per week, the numbers that he has out there. So not necessarily per workout. So if you're doing two workouts a week, you're not going to be able to use those numbers in each workout. And that can affect your recovery too. Frequency can compound in a way that the people wouldn't expect. People notice this when they do fortitude training. Is, you go and you train legs, and maybe you've done a compound exercise and an isolation exercise for your quads on Monday, and then you come in and you're going to train your quads again on Wednesday.
Two
working sets wouldn't be diddly if you're going to train once a week, but you're going to train quads again on Wednesday and then again on Friday.
Yeah.
So the frequency compounds. So that's one, just one factor off the top of my head that can change where those particular volume limits are for you. And he's all about figuring that out on your own. Those are the kind of the main things we're actually pretty much on the same page in terms of most things, at least that we talked about on that podcast.
Nice.
So yeah. So yeah, listen to the podcast for more when that comes out. It was a good time.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. I hadn't known much about him. White Ox had another question related to NAC. He says, what do you think about the possibility of NAC inhibiting gains in adaptations to exercise? You think nutrient timing matters with this, considering many people use NAC for liver support and general health? Now, I had been suggested to not use it around training. Shelby was the one who mentioned that to me, because I think I said I'd use it around training. He said another time of day would be better. Do you agree with that? And if so, I can't remember why he said that was, though.
It's an antioxidant.
Okay. And I've heard of people wanting to keep, and I think you mentioned it once before, and I can't remember why. So this falls into that category, because you said antioxidants post-training is not your best time.
Right. So you don't, the free radical stress that comes with training is important for adaptation.
Okay.
Some animal work, they've shown that it can limit muscle growth. I don't know of any research in humans, but as far as endurance exercise, things like just getting more mitochondria and increasing insulin sensitivity, that won't happen if in people that are dosing like 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C and 400 IUs of vitamin E. So NAC levels are only elevated for like 4 hours or so after consuming them. So you could, for instance, if you train at noon, you know, you could take your NAC at night, you know, and 12 hours later or what have you,
okay,
or 10 hours later, if you go to bed at 10, and then you wouldn't have any overlap. So you wouldn't have any quenching of free radicals and no real issue with basically blunting that very basic stimulus. It's the cellular disruption. We know this in a general way, the cellular disruption of homeostasis is what brings about the adaptation. Like you have to basically create some sort of stress that disrupts the cell, that throws us off its game, so that it has a reason for fortifying its ability to respond to future stress. So that's what adaptation is all about, is some form of fortification. So that could be, if you got a resistance exercise stress, the fortification is to make a larger muscle cell that can produce more force and then can handle any tensile overload that comes its way in the future, i.e. the next time you come and train, you're stronger.
Yeah.
If it's endurance exercise, you know, you want more mitochondria. So you can, you know, make ATP to handle the prolonged need for oxidative phosphorylation and energy demand that comes when you're going out and running for an hour or two. So one of the ways that's sort of sensed by the cell are free radicals. So when you have free radicals will be produced from various mechanisms, but like one of the simplest ones is superoxide. So when you're utilizing oxygen, you're taking in oxygen so you can burn fuel. That ends up getting used in the mitochondria, and there's it's like 3 to 5% of the oxygen that is used there ends up forming, maybe it's less, but some small percentage, but a noted percentage of that oxygen ends up becoming a particular kind of free radical called a superoxide radical. And that can go on and make other different kinds of free radicals. Once you have a free radical, it can sort of perpetuate itself. It's sort of like an infectious agent that can then oxidize other molecules like lipids, and create other free radicals. And we have enzymes to quench those things. But just the fact that we're producing free radicals right now, it's just as a natural sort of, you might consider it like an error of metabolism, but it's almost like there's a persistent like baseline signal that is sort of fine tuning our free radical quenching abilities.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a constant like back tone of free radical production. But when you start exercising and you disrupt the cell's homeostasis, you produce a lot more free radicals. So if you just quench that, like vitamin C or vitamin E or N-acetylcysteine, then you basically have sort of blocked from the cell's sensory mechanisms the fact that there's been some disruption. You've basically undone the signal that you're trying to turn on. It's kind of like if the free radicals are kind of a background hum and the hum gets louder.
Yeah.
Kind of like the hum of these mowers you could probably hear in the background.
I was thinking of saying that, but I was going to not bring attention to it, but it's funny you were thinking that. The listeners may have been thinking it too.
I'm like, am I hearing a hum? Like, this is so strange. He's really hypnotized me with this free radical idea. And I'm like now trying to navigate through my house, closing doors as these guys go around my house. It's pretty funny. So, but if once you have muscle damage or you've exercised, you produce more free radicals, it's kind of like that hum has gotten louder. The mowers are getting closer.
Yeah.
So then you have to do things like I've been doing. I'm trying to adapt to the fact that the mower's here. But if you put headphones on me, earmuffs that block the sound, then I wouldn't know they're there.
So the damage is still done. The mowers are still out. The damage is still done in the gym. But by neutralizing these free radicals, you are not signaling the response to recover as well, is what you're telling me.
Right.
It got real quiet.
Yeah. Well, they're driving away, right? Exactly. So you don't get the adaptations. Okay. And here's the thing. There's one particular study with NAC. That was a perfect segue, Scott. You lined me up perfectly for this. Actually, they found that consuming NAC after some eccentric exercise, they didn't have them do rugby. They just happened to use rugby players. They kind of prevented the repeated bout effect. So this repeated bout effect is you get yourself sore once, and then the next time you go and repeat that particular bout, which would produce soreness, there's less soreness. Well, that's an adaptation that's probably connected with the growth adaptation. And the group that got NAC, or maybe it was in the round of the trial where they gave them NAC, the repeated bout effect was limited. They were sore when they went and repeated that bout after they'd been given NAC. So it prevented the soreness initially, but it also prevented the adaptation to future soreness. They were sore later on down the road. So that's the idea with NAC. This is hormesis. I cover this in my book. It's the term that sometimes people haven't heard, and it's the idea that a certain amount of stress sort of optimizes the adaptation. If it's less, then you get less adaptation. If it's more, you get sort of a maximal adaptation. It fits with Mike's ideas of maximal adaptation. Some amount of training volume would elicit sort of the maximal adaptive response. And then if it's too much, well, then you're moving towards an overreaching or overtraining type of situation where you're doing too many things. So like some of the interesting stuff in this area is, for instance, using NSAIDs. There's a little bit of research with older folks. This came out of Ball State. I've talked about it probably in the show a couple times at least, where they found that although NSAIDs normally limit satellite cell activity and they blunt protein synthesis after resistance exercise, when they gave older folks who tend to get sore more easily, maybe don't have the ability to adapt quite as well, they gave them NSAIDs, and which would blunt that inflammation, and they actually grew better with the NSAIDs.
No kidding.
It probably reduced the insult closer to that sort of best stimulus for producing adaptation. Whereas the training would have been too much otherwise, when they sort of blunted the brunt of the blow of the training bouts, they got better adaptation because they limited the inflammation. Yeah, so yeah, it's a good question. So you want to type NAC is good. Like vitamin C and E, they can be around for like something like a dozen hours. They can be around for a long time. So the thing that I don't know is like exactly how long after the bout, because there's going to be some free radical stress that persists for a long period of time. And you don't also know, you know, to what extent where you are sort of on your optimal hormetic stimulus. So some people might be training too much, and it might be like in the case with these older folks, the anti-inflammatories, I mean, it might be okay for them to take NAC. You know, let's take a situation where someone is doing a lot of training and they just take all their, because they want to, it's convenient and they have a hard time remembering to take all their all their pills and things. They just take all the antioxidant related things. They take their liver. They take a pre-workout oral that stresses their liver, and they take NAC because it'll help with preventing liver stress. It's one of the things that a lot of the liver aids do. They quench free radicals in the liver. So they've got a nice balance going on there. They can train and they can do, you know, 12 or 15 sets for a muscle group, and they take their antioxidants, and that gives them good adaptation. And they're like, oh shit, I'm preventing my adaptation because I'm taking these free radical quenching things like NAC. And now they remove that, and now they've got too much damage. They've got too much free radical stress, and they actually adapt more poorly or not as well, because now they don't have that the NAC or whatever else they might have been taking, sort of optimizing the stress to in the way that the NSAIDs did for those older folks. So that points to the idea that's an old school idea, is just be consistent. You know, whatever you're doing, you know, think about like things like, you know, am I blunting my adaptation with, you know, my antioxidants? Yeah, that makes sense. Avoid that. But once you figure out your pattern, your sort of your you know, your best middle ground, like, okay, I'm not going to just not take any antioxidants when I know I'm producing free radical stress by using orals, let's say, for example. I'm just not going to blow that off. I'm going to take care of my liver. Figure out when you're going to take those. Makes sense. Take them away from your workout. You know, it's just because you're going to have them in there. And then, but then be consistent so that you're not, so that you've got those supporting or not interfering with the stress of your training in a consistent way. And then you can better auto-regulate your training. If you're like flip-flopping and moving it around, like one day you might have those prevent and antioxidants can do this. They can limit muscle soreness. There's a few studies out there, as this one with NAC showed. So all of a sudden you start taking that out, and now you're getting really sore and you're all over the place. So whichever, however you decide to configure your supplement nutrient timing, consistency is important because all those things are interwoven. And this is a way that a lot of people don't really consider, I think.
I've got a question that I know you can't answer, but I feel like I've got to ask it.
Drugs.
Well, no, it wasn't even drugs. It was, okay. It was just that, okay, so, you know, I mean, vitamins, supplements, they are helpful. How real world, how big of an impact do you think this could have on someone? Which I know that's like, there's the saying that people say, I think more in the UK than here is, I know, how long is a piece of string? You can't really answer it, but it makes me want to know, like, how impactful could taking my NAC really be? And I know you don't have an answer, but I'm still going to throw it out there.
Yeah, I don't know of any with NAC. I don't know of any training studies.
Yeah. Okay.
But if you think, if it makes a significant, and noticeable difference in your muscle soreness, here's the thing. That's a great question. So it's going to depend on the person. For one person, let's say that they're sans without any NAC, they've got a really nice training stimulus set up with their particular volume and frequency that they're using.
Okay,
it's pretty close to finding kind of an optimal training stimulus for getting great muscle growth. And then they're like, well, I can make this better. I want to be as healthy as I can. And I'm going to just start taking vitamin E and vitamin C and NAC, like all at once. I'm going to take them, you know, right before I work out. There's a guy, let's say, you know, and there's a guy on my discussion board who posted a diet, and he was taking 2 grams of vitamin C, like literally with his intro workout.
Okay. Like,
and I can't even remember what he said. He had an idea behind taking that. It was like, I don't even know what, you know, it didn't even make sense. It was sort of very generic notion. But so the person with that, back to the person with the optimal strategy, they decided to lump in all those antioxidants, and now they stop getting sore, they stop feeling the things that they normally would feel. I haven't seen again with hypertrophy in humans, but they could really throw themselves off. I think they could substantially limit their potential for growth if they went, you know, on one extreme like that.
Okay.
Now someone else, let's say someone who's just a maniac, you know, who doesn't have great genetics. They're not going to just grow just by, you know, driving by the gym. And but they train a shitload, and they also maybe they take a lot of free radical quenching things as well, a lot of antioxidants. And but they're doing too much. And part of the only reason why they can get away with all that is because they're tempering the stress with those antioxidants. So instead of being like way beyond an optimal stimulus, where they wouldn't adapt at all, they could actually be, you know, backsliding because they're doing too much. They've shifted themselves to the left, and people have my book, and there's a like a hypothetical hormesis plot where as the stimulus goes up, adaptation gets to an optimal point, it goes up and then comes back down, sort of inverted U, and then you go too far, and then you can have maladaptation. You're going the wrong way. So that person who was otherwise just like they train like a knucklehead and they do way more than they should because they're trying to mimic Ronnie Coleman's program or what have you. And they may actually be helping themselves by taking all of those antioxidants. They may actually be, you know, that may be supplementing their recovery ability, which would have been overwhelmed otherwise without all those antioxidants in there. So like those are two ends of the spectrum. So you don't know. It depends on the person, how well they recover, what kind of training they're doing, how much of those antioxidants they're taking, the timing of those. So, I mean, I think you, when you've got like, you know, you when you've got the training stimulus and the antioxidants that are working in opposite directions, to a certain degree, I think it's best that that's complicating things. You know, if you've been doing what you've been doing and it's been working, then it'll probably keep on working. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Keep going there. You know, I wouldn't say to someone who's making great gains and they happen to be taking like, you know, 500 milligrams of vitamin C with their, you know, their pre-workout or something like that. I'm like, keep doing what you're doing. It's fine. You know? If it were like 2 or 3 grams, I'd be like, yeah, well, you know, might think about, you know, see what happens, keep everything the same. And maybe we'll see what happens if you take that out. But, if it's kind of an obvious, like that's a little bit overboard, you know, you can throw it out, but, otherwise, you know, don't, I wouldn't have something in there that counters your training at training adaptation. If at all possible,
that makes sense. So just to plan not to. And yeah. I like the idea too, that you could possibly see the difference in soreness and use that as a judgment.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, not everyone gets sore. The soreness thing is all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, I'm someone who gets really sore, and a lot of people don't. So, yeah, that would be a one way to, you know, sort of judge it. And consistency, and then, you know, only change. This is one of the principles I have in the book too, is, you know, change as few things as you can at once. So you know what is the reason for any change in how well you're adapting or how well you're sleeping or anything that comes about from that change. You want to be able to pin it down as best as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's also nice to know the science is nice to have in your back pocket. Say, oh, shit, you know, I'm really sore now. Okay, you know, I just moved my antioxidants away from my training times. You know, and I mean, I thought you were going to go with that question. You know, vitamin supplementation doesn't have any – there's the epidemiological research doesn't suggest that people would take vitamins and minerals have any greater life expectancy or for the most part, any reduced mortality or morbidity, I mean, than people who don't.
Really?
Yeah. It's the habitual dietary intake of fruits and vegetables.
Okay.
The, like, which probably have all the other phytonutrients and phytochemicals that are good for you. And, you know, in a way that we co-evolved to make use of, you know, it's sort of, the fact that you can, you know, just pull out these particular vitamins that we put into a multi-mineral, it's not a bad insurance policy for someone who, you know, eats like an asshole or, you know, eats, you know, in a very orthorexic way where they don't have a whole lot of variety in their diet. There's not any data that I know that shows it's going to have an adverse effect unless you're just going, you know, hog wild with things and swallowing bottles of pills at a time.
But right.
Yeah. So, but it's not going to be your salvation for, you know, longevity and health, as far as I know.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Well, that's about all we have time for, Scott.
How about that, man?
We got through one question, but we did a lot more. If we were to say we just did a show with one question, well, we did talk about my calves, but then that segued into some really, really cool stuff.
Yeah, it was fun.
I would almost hesitate. Like, I would almost want to edit that part out because I'm like, I don't want it to be about me. But then it turned into something really cool. So I don't edit stuff out anyway on the show. So
never, not really. No, we don't.
No.
No, that was good. No, the calves are like, how often do you get comments about your calves?
Enough that we talk about it on the podcast. I mean, there's podcasts about my calves. That's how
weekly,
often.
Weekly, right?
You know what? I honestly, I don't even really think about it because I feel like if my entire body was that good, I probably wouldn't even want to bodybuild. You know, it's like it's just not exciting because calf training isn't fun to me. I don't really, you know, I don't get anything out of it. There's there's nothing for me to overcome, you know, and get better at.
Yeah. So
that's I guess all I got to say on that. But yeah, right. I've heard it a lot though.
Of course.
Now, if I could only get the rest to match.
Yeah. Do people look at them? I mean, like a woman with really big boobs, like, you know, the guy's eyes are always darting down. Like, you know, like she doesn't notice that you look. Why? Look at me in the eye. I'm talking to you. Not my mouth. My eyes are not down here at chest level. Do people like look down at your legs? Do you ever notice that before?
I've noticed it more than once. Yes.
Usually, okay.
But usually it's cool. Like if it's a pro bodybuilder that I'm talking to, you know, and it's like somebody I want to meet and they're just like, hey, how's it going? And then I'm like, holy shit. Usually that's what Seth Ferrosi said. We were training at the gym. I ran in, I met him and I was like, hey, you know, how's it going, man? They're getting ready to train some chest. I was just starting legs. And as we started talking, he was like, good God. He was like, how did you do that? It's like, as VJ said, it's like my icebreaker with pros.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
I can't imagine Seth Ferrosi using a 4-letter word though. He's so clean spoken.
Yeah, he may not have. He was just he wasn't he, but he made note though. It was fun.
Yeah, he's pretty outspoken dude.
I got to get him on one of the shows. We talked about it and I've been thinking about him again. He seems like a really cool dude and he's away from competition now, but you could tell he still loves training. He still loves the life of being a bodybuilder.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I don't know if there's any topic he wouldn't talk about, to be honest. He's, you know, he's pretty freaking open from what I've seen and heard.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you have going on today, Scott? I know you said you're not feeling too well. Are you training though?
Yeah, I think I'm going to. I think, you know, I got cranked up for the podcast. If I can talk, I can train, right?
Yeah. There you go.
Isn't that the hardcore rule of thumb? Yeah. I'm going to tattoo that on my forearm or something. If you can talk, you can train. Yeah, I think so. I've got some errands to run, so I may have to venture down to an LA Fitness that's near where some of the places are I need to go. So I'll get to try out some, and it'll be a muscle round day, so that matches. I'll be able to try out some exercise, some equipment that I haven't used for a while. So
nice.
Yeah. How about you? You training too?
No, I've been training for the last few days in a row, and I'm due for a day off. Plus, since I'm not feeling too great, today is a perfect day to not train and stay home, work on stuff with the podcast and just get the rest of my work done, clean up a little bit around the house and just kind of keep it low key, I think.
Yeah. It sounds like, is it cold as shit up there too?
Oh, it's terrible. I walked Betsy around the block and we both regretted it.
Yeah. We don't have that issue. It's always nice down here pretty much.
You're lucky, man.
I don't know. I guess so. Yeah, I guess I'm lucky in many, many ways, but I also did make the decision to move to Florida.
That's true. It wasn't just ended up there by chance.
You know, it wasn't like, you know, all of a sudden, like the whole world just got shook up and people got scared. You lucky son of a bitch. How'd you get up to Florida? I'm like, I don't know. Something with driving on the highways and, you know, buying the house, that kind of thing. Well, I did take control of it to some degree.
Make sure you don't put your winter coat too far away though. Don't pack that away because you're gonna need it in maybe about 6 weeks from now at the Arnold.
I don't know if I even. I think I wore shorts when I was there last time. But
did you really?
I don't care. Yeah, I don't get cold very easily.
No,
to be honest. No. I remember the first time. I think it was the first time I went up to Columbus. to see John Meadows, or one of the times he picked me up.
Yeah.
He's picked me up most of the time I've gone up, even if I was just going up for Lead FTS. And so this was many years ago, and he's coming by to get me at the airport, you know, and I said, I sent him a text. I said, I'm the asshole in the shorts, because I just come from Florida, you know, or maybe I was living in Florida at the time. And so I get into his car, and he's actually wearing shorts too. There's snow on the ground. I'm like, okay, here you go. It's not just me. But yeah, I don't get cold very easily. I just, that's something stuck in my head from growing up in the cold. And I haven't, like many, many people I know who grew up in the Midwest or North, they lose their sort of psychological adaptation to cold. I just haven't. I guess I'm just aware that, you know, you don't mind, it doesn't matter.
Right on. Well, and then once we get you in the expo too, you won't need a coat anyway. So it works fine, right?
Oh yeah. I'm already buying some medium size tank tops.
Excellent. Like a stringer. Yeah.
Yeah. I figure I'll have a backpack, and I'll, every time I go to the bathroom, I'll put another tank top on just to
different
refresh
stringer.
My look. Yeah.
Do a couple push-ups.
I gotta find the ones that like run straight down the middle of my nipple. That's my perfect fit.
You cut those out yourself, I think. That's what you gotta do.
That's classy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I like to cut the sides down so that the you can see my like ribs on the side, you know, and my love handle hanging over.
Yeah, yeah. You cut it just above the love handle though. That's the part you hide, you know?
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I keep on forgetting.
Just above. But you don't have love handles anyway. You're too lean for all that.
I got a little bit in there. I got a little bit of loving to grab hold of down there.
Hey, I just put out a show with Maya Underwood, anthropologist from Australia.
Oh, she's awesome.
She's so cool. Yeah, we talked for over an hour trying to, you know, to talk about who and what the modern bodybuilder is in a social context. It was a lot of fun. She had a lot to say.
Did the word outcast come to mind, or?
Not at all. No, not
deviant.
At all. No, not at all. And I think it's interesting because, like I said in the write-up I did, I think that through, you know, we're weird and misunderstood. And I think that through conversations with people like her, she'll be able to better kind of translate who we are to things like the medical community, where it could be of benefit to us long term to improve our ability to get care and health and stuff like that.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. I'm hoping to get us in the DSM at some point in time.
Yeah.
So I can, you know, get free medical care. Maybe they can just like prescribe, you know, we have a need for you know, super physiological androgen levels.
Yes.
Based on, been diagnosed with bodybuilder syndrome.
That's the book they use. That's the book the psychiatrist use, right?
Like yes.
The diagnostic
statistical manual.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Of mental illnesses.
Right. You just walk in with your bodybuilding syndrome, which of course would be abbreviated as BS.
right.
Get your prescription for Anadrol and Tren and all the other goodies.
Perfect. Well, I was thinking about healthcare, but.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's just part of the nature of your psychological disorder. You know, that's kind of what we do with drugs in so many ways is, you know, we recognize that there's aberrant brain chemistry and we just throw drugs at it.
Yes.
To kind of ease the pain, right? There's, we're suffering here from a lack of muscle.
Yeah.
You know,
suffering from small quads.
Exactly. You walk in and you talk to your psychiatrist. You're like, "Ooh, Scott, those quads are looking a little small compared to your calves. I think we're gonna have to up your Tren dose this week. What do you think?"
I like it. I like the way you think.
Yeah. Well, that would be an empathetic position, right? You know, they're thinking about you from a kind, loving perspective.
Yes. All right. Let's get out of here, man.
All right, brother. Enjoy your day, man. Stay warm.
All right, guys, for another episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally. We will see you soon.
Adios.
Devices Radio Network.